On this episode of Interview in Indies, we talk to Paul Lewitsky, the creative director at Chasin' Carrots. We discuss all of their studio's past work and their recently released game, Halls of Torment, that just left early access. If you want to support the show and get it a few days early, you can subscribe to us on Patreon, and of course, enjoy the show. Hello, welcome to Interview in Indies, Episode 7. Today, I'm joined by Paul Lewitsky, the creative director at Chasin' Carrots. And well, Paul, thanks for being here and joining me today.
Thanks for having me. Hi.
I usually like to start off with the age-old question, nice and simple. When did you get into game design? And you can have a very long story if you want.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, it's nice and easy.
When did it start? I kind of faded in. Like, I always wanted to make games, obviously, like it's with most people in my industry that they just started playing games very early on. And that's why I started studying at some point computer science, or actually I misread the name on the application, and it said I thought it was computer science, but in fact it was computer engineering, which is apparently a different thing. It's like more about hardware and microelectronics and stuff like that. But I learned how to program there, and that was enough for me.
That just got your foot in the door.
Yeah, it kind of because I realized I was while I was in high school, I was working on in smaller teams online as a hobbyist on Half-Life mods. So I started in the Half-Life modding community, and I didn't start as a programmer. I started as an artist. I made maps and models and animations and textures, stuff like that. And what we always were missing was a programmer, or the programmers on our team always like left the team or didn't have enough time to program or stuff like that. And so I figured, okay, if I want to make games, I need to learn how to program, because that's always the position that's missing. So yeah, that's how I got into computer science or computer engineering, and became a engineer by accident, and somehow I managed to get back into games by sheer luck and determination, I guess.
So you can do basically everything. You can code, program. You can do art as well. You got it all.
I'm a generalist, but yeah, I'm not very. I didn't master anything of those things. I'm not the particularly good programmer. I'm not the particularly good artist. But I kind of can go in both directions and do the stuff that is required. And that's what I do on Halls of Torment as well. I'm wearing a couple of hats, but there are still people in my team who are more capable in their domains than I am in all of them. So it's always I try to be a bridge between those people and fill the gaps, basically.
Yeah, you know? I mean, every team needs those type of people. And you've been with Chasin' Carrots for a few years now, if I read correctly. But before Chasin' Carrots, you have your own little small projects. Do you have any favorite projects from the past that you want to talk about?
My favorite small game that I've ever made was the very first Game Jam game that I did. I quit my job at an engineering company after my studies, and because I wanted to become self-employed, because I had a gig coming up, and I wanted to go into games, and that was like my jump-off point, basically. And at that time, I also participated in some game jams, and the first game jam I was participating in was Ludum Dare number 38 or something. It was in 2013, and I made my first game in Unity, basically. It was called Grail, and it was like this one button Dark Souls inspired platformer. You just can press one button and the character moves forward, and you have to go through a couple of screens, and it's very short. You can actually make it in 5 minutes, but it has a certain difficulty that was very important to me. And that's also how I got to know Chasing Carrots, because after that one game jam, I decided to participate in a global game jam, which is on site. And in my town, Chasing Carrots were organizing those global game jams. And I didn't know that, but I came in into the on the site, and the guy who was processing the whole registration thing sat at the counter, and at this time that was Joseph, our former producer, and he looked at my name and he said, "Oh, you made Grail." I was like, "What? Somebody
knew your game just like
yes,
that."
Yes, somebody knew our game. It was like, oh my God, this is like crazy. Wow. It was like my first time that I got approached by someone about my games. And it was kind of from there, I got to know the whole team. And they hired me as a freelancer. And after a year and a half, I asked them if I could start permanently working for them as an employee. And since then, I've been here. Making games. Yeah.
So what year did you become a freelancer? So how long have you been with Chasing Carrots?
Okay, let me think. When was that? I think the freelancing work started somewhere around 2014. But I had a gig before that, before working for Chasing Carrots, and we did Pressure Overdrive, which was a remake of the very first game of Chasing Carrots. And that has been released in 2017. And that was like 2.5 years of development. Then it must have been 2015 when I got involved with Chasing Carrots.
2015. So you've been there for almost 10 years now.
Yeah.
Must be a good gig.
Yeah, it had its ups and downs, and it was turbulent at times, but it was always fun. And I realized the first time that when I met the team, I felt at home. Like I was sitting with the guys at the table. We are cooking each day for each other in the kitchen, and we sit together and eat and lunch. And at some point, I asked him, "Hey, it would be great to work here if none of the bosses objects." And Joseph, who was the producer back then, he said, "There are no bosses here."
Oh, and everybody was. There's no CEOs or anything, kind of like Motion Twin. Just you're all just working.
Yeah, kind of. There are co-founders, and they have like on paper they have, of course, the responsibility, and they have the skin in the game. There are these roles, but on a day-to-day basis, you don't notice this. There is like a culture that is very open and very, very, trust-based, you know, and you're on eye level with everyone, and this is pretty cool, and I really enjoyed this, and it was it's to this day it's pretty awesome, because you can talk about everything, be it. Content, be it business or anything, and talk things through. Of course, there are like people who have responsibilities in their areas, and they have the last say. But those they have this responsibilities because of good reasons, right? Right?
Yeah.
They have the competence to do this. I find this a very cool model. But this only works with very small teams. Like we are right now, our team is 5 people, and we have 2 interns right now. In the past, we were 8, but in the recent years, the team got smaller. Like people had different orientations, or went somewhere else, or there were real life things that kind of led them to leave the company. So yeah, that was that's a little bit unfortunate. I loved like the size of 8 people was ideal for me. But still, it's still a blast working here. So yeah,
you can't imagine if you need to have like 30 workers, it would just get messy and convoluted. I bet.
Yeah. At that point, I think you will have to set up some sort of hierarchy and some more administrative roles or something like that. But we are not there, and I don't know if we want to get there. It's kind of like we are thinking of hiring new people, but it depends also on the projects we are doing next. So it's not that certain.
Yeah, you guys do have a lot of history with Chasing Carrots, a lot of different games. I've noticed that you guys made a lot of simulation games besides Pressure Overdrive. What are some challenges with making a simulation game?
Oh boy, I wasn't on board yet when Cosmonautica hit release, but I wasn't involved in the project. I did see it in development, but I wasn't involved in it. But I was deeply involved in Good Company, and those games are complex and hard to pull off. And Good Company was like a 5-year development cycle, basically. So in 5 years, we realized after that is way too long, because Good Company sold pretty well for what it was. The problem was that it costed more than it raked in, you know. So the sales did not cover the development costs, and we kind of realized that we have to go smaller. We simply overscoped in every regard. Even though we had a blast doing the game, but still, like you realize after like 3 years of making a game, you realize like, okay, the energy bar is getting lower.
Yeah, you're running out of energy, and you don't know if it's going to cover everything because you put so many resources in.
Exactly, and you kind of, you still love the game. It's still your baby. You still want to do it, but you kind of get into different moods, and you know, you get slower as well. You get less efficient the longer the project is. And that also, like, that was a big learning for us after we released Good Company. And yeah, having a game like a simulation game, to get back to your question, what it's like to make a simulation game, it's a lot of quality assurance that you can't do because you don't have the time, basically. You have to imagine, when you have a simulation game, you usually those sessions, they last like many hours. Like you play one game of Good Company for maybe 30 or 40 hours. And that's not a time frame that is realistic where you can test your game by yourself. You have to sit down, you have to hire people to play your game, basically, to cover all the bugs and cover all the mechanics and the balancing, which is crazy in itself. So that was like very, very a daunting task, a very, very hard endeavor for us to get things right. And as I said, that was a learning, and we transferred this into Halls of Torment and said, okay, Halls of Torment is going to be like a game. We will have a full-fledged game with minimal content within 6 months. And that's what we got.
You guys got definitely it done. Delivered on that.
Yeah, and it was like, that was a godsend, because the structure is totally different from a simulation game. Like, one run is 30 minutes, and 30 minutes is like the time frame you can expect to test things that you built in into the game. And it's pretty refreshing to know, okay, when I test this, I won't have to play the game for longer than 30 minutes, or even less. It depends on what I'm testing, of course. That's kind of like this whole the big contrast between like simulation games that are very time consuming, and like are very complex in their implementation, because you have a ton of systems that are intertwined, versus like a game like Halls of Torment that is very has a very simple structure.
And, yeah, you and just go around and straightforward. Kill yeah. everything.
Now, exactly.
With Halls of Torment, that was an early access project. And was Good Company an early access game, or were you just trying to release it fully right when it's done?
Oh yeah, it was an early access game. We started Like when we did we start working on it? We started in 2017, second half, I think, as far as I remember correctly. And then it took us 2.5 years to get into early access, like having the early access release. So we released the game in 2020 into early access. And that was like right in the middle of Corona lockdown. And that was like a little bit underwhelming because everybody was at home and we had our release party from home, like via Zoom or via Discord. But the good thing was that we had a publisher and the publisher was financing us. So that was like a very cool experience, like not having to worry about financing and stuff like that. And having like a couple of people and producers that have your back on the business side of things and stuff like translation and stuff like QA and testing.
The annoying things in game development.
Yes, yeah. The things that you don't want to do as a programmer or artist. That was pretty cool. And the team was great. Also, like our publisher was very cool. And yeah, that was very refreshing and new for us as well, like having like such a cool partner with us. And yeah.
Was that the first game that was published?
No, the very first game of Chasing Carrots, Pressure, like the original Pressure, but because we re-released it with an update, like a remaster, which was called Pressure Overdrive, which was my first freelance job for Chasing Carrots. And that one came out in 2013, the original one. And that has been also published by a publisher. But that was a whole different experience. And I only have secondhand stories, so I won't tell them here. you would have to talk to our co-founders. They have very interesting stories about that.
I hear a lot of horror stories from people getting published. And then there's also a lot of good stories, like you just said. Now, Halls of Torment, does that have a publisher with it, or are you guys just doing all that yourself?
No, we did all by ourselves because we realized no publisher would be prepared to publish a game with such a small budget because they kind of have an upper limit. Like I think the typical entry point for small games in publishing is like above $500,000 usually.
God dang.
And it's not that much actually if you look at how many people are working on a game and how long. And we our target was like below 200,000 like in cost in budget, right? And that's kind of like where we hit the mark when we released into early access in 2022, like after the 6 months of doing the first version of the game. So we have been approached by publishers and they were asking us, would you like to partner with us? And we were talking with them and we were like, this is our plan. We want to release it very quick. We want to have this price because games in this genre cannot be over a certain amount, you know, like Vampire Survivors set an expectation for the genre already, you know. And if you come around the corner with a game that costs like $12, you kind of you have a hard time selling your game. Although there have been like good games in the genre that sold for more, but we kind of were. We realized, okay, we have to keep the cost down and keep the price down. And that kind of like, oh no, this is a 10 euro game minimum or 10 bucks game minimum. Never, don't do that. And release later this year.
They were telling you all these things that you didn't agree with.
Yeah, and we were like, no, we have our plan. We don't want to deviate from our original plan. So that was a good decision to like do it ourselves, and because with publishers, you know, it's usually like typical clauses that they recoup their finances, and then you get your revenue as a developer. So you kind of you're carrying quite a lot of risk as a developer, which is like that's a typical thing. Like that's a typical contract that you would get in the industry as an indie dev. But that after the release of your game, that leaves you like with the revenue that the game does after this whole budget has been refinanced. And most of the time, it's a very slim margin, you know? And it's most of the time for most games that got published, it's not enough to like carry the whole studio. So you are kind of in the obligation to find a new publisher quick for your next project, right? Finance it, and you and that's how the treadmills starts spinning. You go from publisher to publisher, or you maybe you already have a good relationship to your former publisher, and you pitch them a new game, and then you can start again, and then it works. But there are many studios that are like jumping from publisher to publisher, and like kind of the games make money, but not enough for the dev to kind of be safe and have a longer runway, basically. So this is like a difficult thing, but that's what I heard from other indie devs as well.
Did Halls of Torment really extend your runway in terms of how much like freedom you don't have to really worry about getting financed anymore? Did that really help because Halls of Torment was so successful?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's Halls of Torment is the most successful game we've made financially to this day.
Was it the cheapest game as well to buy?
Yeah.
That's just crazy to think about. Like, it's just a simple game. Now, you mentioned Vampire Survivors, which is obviously, it didn't like start the genre, but it's definitely the catalyst of it. Everyone thinks of that game. When you were making Halls of Torment, like, what was something you were trying to think of, like to implement to make your game stand out so it can compete with something like Vampire Survivors?
We kind of, I'll step back a little bit and tell you the story how I got to play Vampire Survivors the first time, because when Vampire Survivors came out and I saw screenshots and videos of it, I was like, I'm not interested in this. This is some kind of meme game, blah blah blah, you know, the typical hype.
Yeah.
And then Dominic, who's here behind me programming, he's also the co-founder, one of the co-founders of this studio. He approached me and said, look, I have this. Did you also see like this newsletter from this marketing guy about 20 Minutes Till Dawn? Like 20 Minutes Till Dawn was also like this, one of the early successful genre like adopters. And we were looking at the game and we liked the game very much. And we realized, yeah, this is really, really a very fun game made with very few, you know, elements that work very well together. And we played it, and our producer Mara, she also got to play it, and then she came to me and said, Paul, if you like 20 Minutes Till Dawn, you will love Vampire Survivors. You have to play it. And I said, okay, Mara, if you say I have to play it, then I have to play it. Because we are always in exchange game design wise, and I played it, got very addicted to it, and realized, okay, this game has so many ingenious design decisions. I really underestimated it at first glance, and then I was like, wow, this is something out of the ordinary. There are so many small elements that are so well thought through. I don't think we can compete with that, but we can approach it. And if we manage to make like 10% of that, that would be a win for us. And we also looked at all the other I call them copycats, but that's an unfair statement. Not copycats, like other games who were like trying to get into like yeah, basically copying the gameplay of Vampire Survivors. We looked at them and we played a lot of them, and we realized, okay, we can do better actually. We won't be able to achieve what Vampire Survivors did, but we might get into second or third place in the genre with what we are comfortable doing and doing. So we kind of thought how can we distinguish ourselves from other games? And one big lesson from Good Company was that the visual style of the game has to kind of communicate the kind of game that you will play, like the mechanics and the type of experience you have should kind of be reflected by the visual style, and it should not only attract the right people but also deter the wrong players that are not your target audience. Because with Good Company, it was like a very complex game with very with a very complex simulation and you know, spreadsheets and stuff like that, employee management, logistic chains and stuff like that. And the look is very cozy and, you know, cute almost and warm looking and inviting. And people who were attracted by that got very, you know,
complex game, and they were like, oh,
exactly. God. Yeah, they were like, oh, this is not what I expected. And that also, like, in the end, this will also kind of have a negative effect on your reviews and consequently on your sales. So we kind of, okay, what fits very well with Vampire Survivors type of game? Like, Diablo would fit well. Like these two things, there is a big overlap between those two areas, like action RPGs and survival likes, or bullet hell games, or bullet heaven games, as they were called back then. So we figured, hey, let's take like this old pre-rendered retro look that is kind of ugly, but still kind of has its nostalgia charm, and put the game into it, and make a game around it, and also like pull ideas and concepts from those older ARPGs into the bullet hell genre. And that's how we found our mixture for Halls of Torment.
So you went the more aesthetic, more nostalgic route with Diablo inspiration. That's very smart, because like you said, you can't really compete with Vampire Survivors with how big they are. Now, like when you started this project, did you expect it? I don't really know the top games in the genre, but did you expect Halls of Torment to be one of the best ones just straight out the rip?
No. Actually not. We were after Good Company, as I might have hinted at, we were kind of in a financial troublesome situation. We still had some budget, but not that much. We had to come up with ideas quickly. And the whole plan of doing like a derivative game came from our situation, basically. We had to compromise. Because we always wanted to do original new things, but that is always a very high risk. And whenever you have a new idea, it always looks grand and awesome in your head. But unless you have a good prototype that proves your concept, you are kind of out in the wild. And we have so many prototypes on our backup that kind of have an idea, but they show that the idea doesn't work, basically. And that's what you need a proof of concept, and we wanted to have a very quick iteration, and therefore we kind of compromised on originality gameplay wise. So we kind of thought, okay, this won't be like the big hit, but as soon as it will make its investment back and have like a long tail or a constant output monetary wise, we will be able to do another small game and another one, and then we have a bunch of them, and all of them have like small revenue streams, but together they kind of add up to enough money so we can keep the lights on. And with more titles in the backlog, or in our portfolio, we kind of have the chance or a higher chance of having actually a hit, because having a hit is mostly luck, basically. It depends on what currently is on vogue, what people are hungry for, what's the cultural, you know, fluctuation, stuff like that. And you never know what will be super successful in the games on the games market. It's very hard to tell. Of course, you analyze things and you kind of can assess risks. But it was, for us, it was like a risk minimization approach, and as such, it was not meant to be like, oh, we are making a hit here. We didn't expect that, not at all.
So it was a nice surprise that it kind of blew up, and now after early access, I think it has like 12,000 reviews on Steam, overwhelmingly positive. Everyone in my community, they all love it. Everyone's addicted to it, which I'm sure is very nice to hear. But you talk about some revenue streams. What about porting Halls of Torment to other platforms like consoles? Is that on the back of your mind?
That's not just on the back of our minds. It's also like, it's happening right now, but since we are working with Godot, we have to overcome some hurdles. The biggest hurdle is the Nintendo Switch. The other consoles, we don't worry that much about, because that they work already, almost. I mean, the Xbox works. PlayStation, we didn't try out yet, but it shouldn't be a problem. The biggest problem is performance for us. We have to do a lot of performance optimizations, so the game runs on the Switch. And I can't promise that we will release on Switch, because everything depends on the game running smoothly on the console. So this is something we are actually working on. And I think we will release on other platforms as well. There is already a mobile port, but this one is done by a separate publisher. We just gave them our code and they did their thing, and we said, okay, you can release the mobile game. We don't have any hand in this. Do it, because we are very inexperienced with mobile. Or we kind of try to avoid mobile because the market is very different and distorted, in my opinion. So we kind of gave that off to another company, and we just get a revenue share from the sales. But yeah, consoles are still on the table, but not confirmed.
I can imagine Switch is really hard because it's such an old console, and when you get into the meat and bones of a Halls of Torment run, you have a lot of stuff on the screen. So I want to ask you, is like coding something like that, you know, thousands of enemies appear and thousands of little assets, is that a mess to code and even more of a mess to optimize for something like Switch?
To optimize, yes. I personally, I'm not deep in the technical stuff. I would have to ask Dominic back there. He is he's doing all the magic around code optimization. But yeah, there's been a ton of work optimization wise to make like the game run more or less fluently in very busy situations. On the Steam Deck, for example, because the Steam Deck also has its limits, of course. But yeah, we initially, when we had like this 1,000 monsters on the screen, we had severe frame drops. And over the time, with Dominic's help or Dominic's hard work, we kind of managed to overcome this, and then the game ran smoother and smoother with every iteration. So yeah, there was a lot of work done there, definitely.
I don't even want to imagine that. And I want to kind of go back to the mobile port for a second and get your opinion on it. Like you guys said, you're not experienced in mobile gaming, but do you feel like, I guess we can say the bullet heaven genre, even roguelites as a whole, do you feel like it could be a big step for a developer to get their game on mobile because it's such a giant market?
It's hard to On mobile, I can tell you anything about mobile. I don't have any experience myself with mobile. I made one mobile game at the start of my career as a freelancer, and it completely tanked. It didn't make a cent. And I kind of, it's a very different market, and I can't tell you. But regarding the survival-like genre, I don't know if the bonus, the hype bonus of the genre is still there. I believe it's not. I think that the tides have ebbed there.
Oh yeah, it's been a few years now.
Yeah, if you make a survival-like now, you really have to be a special game to kind of take off like the first ones did. Because, I think people tired out on the games pretty quickly. And, it also shows, like, we have released our 1.0 version. Or, like, we released out of Early Access last week. And we saw this like in our numbers. The numbers were not bad, but they were a little bit under our expectations, which is okay. We are still fine. We are still happy about how it went. It's still a success for us. But we kind of feel like, okay, this genre is, our next game won't be a survival, like, most probably, because we have to look out for new. New ideas and new genres where we can kind of make an impact, you know. Also for ourselves, like creativity-wise, we need some refreshment, basically.
Yeah, you don't want to want to make the same genre every single time. Yeah. Imagine it could get a little tedious just coding a million monsters.
Even though it is like tempting to do that, because you learned a lot of lessons and you want to apply them, and you want to do, like, I can do this better a second time, like with new ideas, but still, like, you have to look out on the for the market, and I don't think it's if you want to make a hit, that this is like the right path. If you start out as a new indie, it might be a good start for you to make a small project and make a little bit of money, of course, but don't expect a hit by all means, because this is very unlikely to happen, I think.
I mean, I still get tons of emails about people saying, hey, play this new insert name here Survivors game. Let me ask that. Do you think having survivors in your game name could also hinder it? Because, like you said, people are a little worn out of it. Do you feel like people need to be a little more creative with the name and the branding?
Oh, I never thought of that. Names are, yeah, you're right. There is like a whole, science around naming games with using keywords that are very popular at the time. I don't know. I wouldn't do it. I can imagine that it works both ways. That people who still want to play survivor games, like, would jump on named games that aren't called Survivors, because this is like this. You observe this very often in the mobile space, like Hero Survivors, Hero Heroes, Armor Heroes, or Idol, blah blah blah. You know, like these keyword names, because people search for titles. But I don't think that this works pretty well for PC games on Steam. I think you need a name that is recognizable, and that kind of communicates what the game is about, and that give people the right expectation, and that's also like. Kind of that people that get stuck in your head. Like, for example, we have a developer friends here in Germany. They are making a game that's called Planetenverteidigungskanonenkommandant. Like, this is a German name, like very, very long.
Is that the Domekeeper devs?
Yeah, that's the Bippin Bits, the Domekeeper devs. And they did this PVKK game. And this is like a like marketing genius, because it's like a very hard to pronounce German name, and still like you see this long word, and you recognize it, you know, and you still can shorten, like use a shorthand like PVKK. So stuff like that, I think, works pretty well. If you come up with a very, very cool idea how people can remember your game, I think that's the way to go.
I mean, PVKK, that's definitely... Could you pronounce it again? Because I genuinely cannot pronounce it.
Planetenverteidigungskanonenkommandant.
That game, that's... I love Bip and Bits, though, but...
I'm looking forward to the game. I'm really hyped for it, yeah.
All right, I got more questions, do not worry. Sure. So... you guys aren't super big on social media, I've realized. Like, you have Chasing Carrots has their own Twitter, but the Halls of Torment Twitter, it seems a little more barren. Do you guys just not care to use social media too much? It has like some posts, but it doesn't have as much as a following as you would expect for how big the game is.
We actually, if there is a Halls of Torment Twitter account, it's not managed by us.
There is a Halls of Torment. I think it might be the mobile version. But there Halls of Torment Twitter account.
It might be that the publisher of the mobile port started a Twitter account, but we are not that active on Twitter. I take a peek once in a while, but I kind of use the platform less and less. I'm personally more active on Mastodon, but even there I don't post that often. I use it mostly for reading or chatting to my friends. We used to be more active in social media, especially during the time of Good Company. We tried out like this it's called marketing first approach. Like, the first thing we did for our game was like a trailer without having anything working in the game. We got kind of like just for ourselves, like to visualize the game and have a vision in trailer form. And we kind of started to work in those social media trenches, so to speak. But that's a lot of work, and you need like at least one dedicated person to do this, and it kind of never worked out well for us. So we realized we have to find other ways to promote our games. And with Halls of Torment, it was like more like contacting streamers and approach streamers, giving out keys, try to grow our audience organically via different things. Like, one marketing stunt, it's not a stunt, it's like just a decision we've made, was to release 2 weeks before Diablo 4.
Oh, because it looks like Diablo, so people will be like, oh, yeah, let's try this game out before
exactly.
I get addicted to Diablo 4. That's pretty smart.
Yeah, because Diablo, Blizzard would start marketing the game long before launch, like a couple of weeks. And people would get pretty excited about it and would like to play the game, but the game is not out yet. So they would look for a substitute, and voila, there we are. You know, you can, as long as Diablo 4 isn't out, you can like get your fix with Halls of Torment, basically. So that was the idea. And I believe it worked out pretty well, because we saw a lot of mentions of Diablo 4 in our reviews on Steam, and that was pretty funny. But yeah, it was like one thing that we did specifically for marketing. And we've also learned the lesson that marketing is mostly like half of marketing is picking your genre right and having the right look to the game, like having the proper, the visuals that kind of attract the right people. And that's like half of marketing for us. Maybe also like time to market, like when do you release, and the pricing. And the rest is kind of like a multiplier for this base, fundamental thing, the package you set up.
Did you implement any other strategies for marketing besides, you know, going near Diablo 4 and sending out to streamers? Anything else to, I guess, give the people?
Yeah. We tried different things that failed. Like, we tried Google Ads, and that went nowhere. But mostly because we are not very experienced with that. I think somebody who is very experienced with paid ads could have done more in that direction. But that requires like a certain budget. Like, and you have to try out different. You have to do like an A/B testing sort of thing where you try out different keywords and see which perform better in long-term measurements. This is like something this is like witchcraft for me. I know nothing about that. But that didn't work well. I tried to dip my toes in social media again, like in Imgur, how it's called.
That photo website.
Yeah, that photo website, exactly. And that didn't work at all. Like nobody, like I got thousands, not thousands, like a couple of downvotes, and that's it. And what did we try? Yeah, what worked the best was sending out keys to targeted streamers where we think, okay, this person is streaming like the Survivor likes a lot. Let's send them a key. Like, let's contact them and like have a list, and also like approach also the smaller ones, because when smaller streamers and content creators play your game, the content creators get bigger and bigger, because they, at some point when there is a critical mass, they can't ignore you. And they have to like, oh, there is like hundred of streamers that or YouTubers that have played this game. It's popping up left and right, so I'll try it as well. And it's like an organic growth there. So that worked out pretty well. But other than that, we didn't succeed in any other approaches. So
yeah. I ask a lot of indie devs what their best marketing things were, and it seems like just giving the keys out to streamers were always the best. Mm-hmm. Some people say the sponsorships they've tried didn't really work. So would you say just giving keys is even better than even offering a sponsorship at times?
I have no experience with sponsorship, so I can't
tell. Really,
but,
say.
But, yeah.
Yeah, that's a whole,
but giving out keys. Yeah, yeah.
Now, no, you can continue. Sorry.
No, it's fine. I just wanted to repeat that. Yeah, for us it worked out to giving out keys to the right people.
That does always work. I wanted to say each game that Chasing Carrots made seems like it has a different art style to it, with Good Company and Halls of Torment obviously is very simple pixel art. Now, was it just pretty easy to change the art style every time you make a game, because you guys are very talented over there, or was there any challenges to that?
It's always pretty organic in that way. We usually have pretty good artists, and our artists are very versatile. And we kind of sit down together and figure out an art style and a look. And the first two games of Chasing Carrots, Cosmonautica and Pressure, they have a similar look, because they have like the character artist who did the concepts for the characters was one guy, and you kind of see like a little bit of his signature style. But after that, like, we always tried to explore new looks. With Good Company, there is like, we had an artist here, a concept artist. Her name was Chantal, and she worked here for quite a while, and she kind of defined like the whole look, the color palette, and the shape long language and stuff like that. And our art lead, basically, and our 3D lead, Daniel, he's always very, very focused on like having a consistent look. So with Halls of Torment, for example, it was like I made a couple of example sprites that for me looked like I remembered Diablo and Diablo 2, Like for me, it was, this is how Diablo 1 looked like in my mind. And I presented this to the team, like this might work out. And from then on, we kind of extrapolated, like with Daniel's help, how the game should look like. So it's not like just pixel art, it's a pre-rendered thing. Like we have very low detail 3D models that we animate, and then we render them in a low resolution into sprite sheets, and we have these sprite sheet animations. And we also have like a dynamic 2D lighting that also like adds a lot of atmosphere to the scenes. So that comes on top. That's something that Diablo didn't have, like dynamic lighting, like that dynamic per pixel lighting with normals and stuff like that. But still, it still evokes the memory of the game. So that was our goal. So we kind of explore the look for each game from a new angle and try to find something that fits the game and the theme. And if you have good artists, they can adapt usually.
Oh yeah, I looked at a lot of the past work. All the art in every Chase and Kara game looked fantastic, including Halls of Torment. So that's I do like hearing that process though, just to make the game the way it looks. Now, for Chase and Kara's future, do you guys have any? You guys always thinking of the next big idea, or how long do you plan on working on Halls of Torment now that 1.0 is out?
Yeah, we have ideas all the time. We don't run out of them. The tricky part is always like picking the one that might succeed. And we plan to maintain Halls of Torment for a while, of course. We are thinking of some additional content, but there is nothing that we could announce yet for that. But that will not like be our main work from now on. We want to go into prototyping more and try different ideas that we still have. And we already have like two or three prototypes going on in our development process. But we always like, this is not it. And you're kind of always on the fence on certain ideas, and it's kind of I always forget how exhausting this is. Like, okay, this might work, or it won't. Like, it's very difficult.
You just predicting which one's the best.
Yeah, and I always envy other devs that are like, hey, this worked out well. I tried this little thing, and I just went on with it, and then suddenly I had a game. And I hear this over and over, like people just having fun and then having a game at the end. And sometimes it works like that. I like Good Company was not Good Company. House of Torment was almost like that. Like we just started making the game, and it kind of materialized. But with prototypes, it's always, you don't see the finished game. You have to put a lot of imagination into it to see if this kind of catches the attention. Yeah.
And that's basically all the major questions I had, but I do have one more question before I let you go and probably get back to work. And it's Sure. Do you have any questions for me, the content creator and the gamer?
Oh boy. What? Yeah. Probably ton of questions if I think of it. What games would you like to play next? What I don't know what type of gamer you are, but it would interest me. Like
currently for me, I'm a lot into the platformers. I like Metroidvanias and platformers, but I know Metroidvanias are probably mess to make, but I'm always a big fan of platformers. I've noticed a lot of cozy games are kind of popping up. There's a whole lot of games, a lot of Hades looking style games. Mm-hmm. I also really like top down shooters like Enter the Gungeon. So anything in those spheres always grab my attention the most.
Yeah, I was thinking because we realized that this whole roguelite structure, it's used by a lot of indies because it's easier to make like content that you can play over and over again and keep the game engaging. If you have like a campaign that has a story and like distinct handcrafted levels, you work your butt off basically to make this happen and have enough play time for the players that they are satisfied. So do you think people would get tired of this, like this roguelite formula, or is it something that is here to stay?
It's been popular, I think, now for 12 years. I think Binding of Isaac kind of really blew it up in Spelunky. Obviously, the rogue genre has been around forever, but I do think it's here to stay personally because every single year, more and more games are coming up with unique styles, and there's never going to be too many games. Like, you could have the most simple game in the world and just add a roguelike twist to it, and you can make millions, really. Just look at Balatro. It's just poker. Mm-hmm. But they add the roguelite twist. It's probably one of the biggest games of the year. So I don't think the genre is going to go anywhere anytime soon.
Yeah, I haven't thought of that, of course. Yeah, I mean, Binding of Isaac was like a decade ago, more than a decade. Boy, oh boy, I'm old. Because that's what was like when I was looking back on Halls of Torment. It was like, okay, we have this roguelite structure in it, but you can't apply this roguelite structure on every genre. Like, you can do FPSs very well with roguelike. You can do like top down shooters as a roguelite. But there are certain genres that don't work, like a simulation game, obviously.
Yeah, that's hard maybe to do.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it would work, but
you never know.
But in my experience, roguelites work best if you have like one focused moment-to-moment gameplay thing, like a character that you control or something like. And that kind of like that's where my mind right now is in this prototyping phase. Like, should I go down that route or not? That's why I asked this question, you know.
It could be good. Like you said, the most genres, I feel like, do have some type of roguelite element. And with simulation games, I don't know if I've seen any big ones. I've seen stuff that comes close to it, like with a game like Plate Up. I don't know if you've seen Plate Up, but that's like you run a kitchen in that game. And I've seen people get really into it and kind of have the whole kitchen just run itself, but it still has the roguelite elements to it, so it is definitely doable.
Okay, interesting. I have to look it up. Plate Up, you say? Yeah, okay. I have to
yeah, look that one up. You might see some simulation similarities in there.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, we don't know where we will end up next, but I hope we start soon. Because I'm ready for a new thing. But yeah, also like on the sideline, we will have Halls of Torment coming, more Halls of Torment content coming probably soonish, I hope. Yeah.
Yeah, you're always we'll ready see. To go. Want to just get... I mean, I can't imagine making a game, but I'll be keeping my eye on whatever you guys make, that's for sure.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
And thank you.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for coming on and taking some time out of your day. If you want to sell anything out, tell anything to the people that will be listening and watching, just say it now.
Oh, I don't have anything to sell besides our games, but and we talked about it.
Halls of Torment is doing just fine.
Yeah. So, just take care and have fun. That's my message out there.
All right, everyone, thanks for listening and watching to Interviewing Indies, and big thanks again to Paul for coming on and talking all games with me. Paul, it was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for watching or listening to this episode of Interviewing Indies. If you're an indie developer and you want to get on this show, shoot me a DM on Twitter or email me. And if you want to get the show a few days early, you can subscribe to us on Patreon for that to happen. And of course, wishlist Halls of Torment. Thanks again for listening or watching, and we'll see you next time.